Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find information on the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is the 10th in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club, and I am your moderator for tonight. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Louise Burnham Packard. For much of her career, Louise was raising money for other people and other institutions' causes. She successfully raised millions for Harvard and Stanford business schools when Trinity Church in Boston lured her away to undertake one of the most ambitious church-sponsored capital campaigns ever launched. After raising a staggering $53 million, Trinity realized what a star they had with Louise. When she proposed creating the Trinity Boston Foundation, the first organization of its kind under the auspices of an Episcopal church, they readily agreed. As we know, giving through churches is the largest type of giving in the United States. Innovation within this space is hugely important and often overlooked by others talking about social innovation and entrepreneurship. It is for this reason I am delighted that Louise is with us tonight to share her experience and be part of this series. Ladies and gentlemen, Louise Burnham Packard.
I'm so honored to be included among the distinguished group of social entrepreneurs who make up this lecture series. And I'm also honored to be asked to represent my brothers and sisters who work in faith-based organizations. So thank you, Ruth, for inviting me to speak. The Trinity Boston Foundation probably needs a new name. We don't have an endowment, and we don't give away money. We're a subsidiary of Trinity Church in Boston with a mission of changing the odds for Boston youth, particularly around educational achievement, violence, and incarceration. We pursue that mission in three ways. We run direct service programs. We work to improve community health and cohesion across Boston through collaboration with other organizations. And with our partners, we work for change at the systems level to improve the lives of those we would never be able to reach through our direct service programs. I'm going to talk tonight about why we created the foundation, why we've chosen this multi-pronged approach, and why I believe that the nonprofit sector's disparate efforts to address poverty and social inequality leave many assets untapped or underleveraged. I'm going to suggest that the best way to discover and deploy those assets is through building and strengthening community, not just within city neighborhoods, but across neighborhoods and out to the suburbs, not just a web of individual relationships, but also organizational partnerships and networks that weave together the faith-based organizations, social enterprises, and traditional nonprofits that make up our social sector. 4 years ago, a pastor in Boston who chaired the board of our community foundation told me that Boston was resource-rich and coordination-poor. I think that is less true today because our sector has worked hard to build relationships and get connected. And at the Trinity Boston Foundation, we've tried to do our part. But first, what is a faith-based organization? The many forms of faith-based organizations defy a quick summary. Entrepreneurs who are people of faith have created extraordinary organizations that reflect their faith perspective and priorities. Various denominations have formed large social service organizations in the U.S. and abroad. And then there are all the faith communities, congregations, that provide social services to members and non-members. You may think that congregation-based social services are a small part of the social service sector. Not so. One study in Philadelphia showed that the replacement value of the social services provided by congregations in that city was $250 million, and the total investment by the city of Philadelphia in social services was $522 million. That's a lot of social service, but note that the statistic is about replacement value, not direct expenditures. Congregations have significant assets to leverage, like buildings that might otherwise be empty during the week, a volunteer labor pool ready to put their faith into practice, a history and connection to their community that can make them informed and effective players. All of these assets enable congregations to deliver significant services on frugal budgets. There is a lot of value embedded in America's congregations, and the geographic density of those congregations is unsurpassed. When we created the Trinity Boston Foundation, we talked a lot about the assets of Trinity Church and how the foundation's organizational structure could help us leverage them on behalf of the community. But I believe that the most valuable asset that congregations and other faith-based organizations can leverage is faith. Faith that there is great love at work in the universe that seeks justice, mercy, peace, and joy. Our various faith traditions and practices teach us how to stay open to that love, tap into it, to align ourselves with it, and be empowered by it. What does faith look like in an organization? Despite great diversity in form and focus, there are common values I typically see in organizations where the leadership is intentional about putting faith into practice. Relationships and community. There is an emphasis on building relationships and partnerships and accruing a deep understanding of the surrounding community. Today's needs. In response to critical needs, there is a bias for today versus tomorrow, action versus caution, spending versus saving. Flexibility. Nimble response to opportunities or changing circumstances is prized over disciplined adherence to a multi-year plan. There's a willingness to pursue promising but risky ideas without paralysis due to fear of failure. A holistic approach. The emphasis on relationship and community inspires the leadership to see the needs of the whole person and want to help. And often the approach is accompanied by a whatever it takes determination. Big dreams. The organization has the courage to make leaps of faith, to tackle big challenges or pursue big ideas despite a lack of visible resources. Now, this is not the list that typically headlines a social enterprise conference. So let me give you an example of these values in action. It's a story I'm pretty sure you've heard before. The feeding of the 5,000, also called the miracle of the loaves and fishes, is one of only two miracles included in all four Christian Gospels. The other is the resurrection of Jesus. As a busy executive director and as a parent, I love how this story begins. Jesus is tired. He's been teaching and healing nonstop, and all he wants to do is go off by himself somewhere to pray. But the crowd follows him. They are hungry for spiritual food, for healing, for a message of hope. And now they are physically hungry too. The disciples come to Jesus and say, "Send the crowd away so that they may go into the surrounding villages and countryside to lodge and get provisions, for we are here in a deserted place." But Jesus says to the disciples, "You give them something to eat." Note the big idea with no visible resources to execute on it. Also note the holistic approach. He does not say, "Well, my job is healing and teaching, but food distribution is not in my business model." In response, the disciples say exactly what any good CFO or board treasurer would say. "It's not in the budget. It would cost 200 denarii. All we have are 5 loaves and 2 fish. So Jesus does two things. First, he says, "Make them sit down in groups of about 50 each." Here's the focus on relationships and community. Let's imagine for a moment that we are in that crowd. We've been watching Jesus hanging on his every word, and now we sit down in smaller groups. We take our eyes off the leader, and we start looking at each other. We say, "Oh, you are from my village. Oh, you have a child about my child's age. Oh, You're older and might need some help sitting down on the ground. We look at each other and we form relationships. We see each other as individuals and we begin to care. The second thing Jesus did was to take the 5 loaves and 2 fish, bless them, and give them to the disciples to set before the crowd. You know how the story ends. All ate and were filled. What was left over was gathered up, 12 baskets of broken pieces. Now, my understanding of this miracle is this. Jesus forms communities, models generosity, which in turn inspires the crowd to be generous. They open up their knapsacks and share what they have, and it was more than enough. What did each of us in the crowd have to do to create that miracle? We had to look at the loaf of bread or piece of fruit in our knapsack and override our impulse to save it for later, maybe for breakfast tomorrow. The tensions were between our own needs and the needs of others, the present need and a future need. Inspired by the power of community, the generosity of Jesus, and the connection we felt to each other, we shared. And not only were our physical needs met, our spiritual needs were met too. We were part of a miracle. 5 loaves, 2 fish, 5,000 people fed, no denarii changing hands, no government contract, no fundraising, no earned revenue. Don't we want to analyze that process, replicate it, take it to scale? I would argue that faith communities replicate that miracle in small ways all year round. The question then is one of scale. Let me name 4 things in this story that we've tried to put into practice at the Trinity Boston Foundation. 1, leverage existing assets. The food was already in the knapsacks. We need to get as good at deploying what already exists as we are at creating something new. Build relationships and community. We need to focus on building relationships both within our enterprises and with external partners. At Trinity, we're taking this one step further by working to strengthen institutions, specifically churches and schools, that themselves have the capacity to be engines of community. Model generosity. Jesus gave all he had to the crowd. And we need to not be so focused on our own plan and our own bottom line that we miss significant opportunities to collaborate and leverage our assets in partnership with others. 4, recognize that our hunger for connection, meaning, and purpose is the most powerful asset in our knapsack. My own theological framework links spiritual hunger to the power of divine love. The two are always seeking each other. And when connected, they can make the seemingly impossible possible. I think the point holds up without the theology, and let me state it that way, too. The world is teeming with people who are feeling that something is missing in their lives. To the extent we can offer connection and meaning, we can create appetite, public appetite, and will for social change. So on to Trinity, where I wanted to begin by telling a modern version of the loaves and fishes story. I joined the staff of Trinity Church in 2001. The move seemed more than a little counterintuitive at the time. I'd been director of development at Harvard Business School, and somehow I'd left that resource-rich environment to become capital campaign director for an Episcopal parish that had set an audacious goal, raising $53 million to put their building, a masterpiece of American architecture, to work supporting their church community and the greater Boston community. Now, as I said, I had a lot of development experience, and I knew the goal was too high. One rule of thumb for a capital campaign is 10 times annual giving. That would have set the bar at about $30 million, and we were going for $53. I'm not sure how Jesus knew there was a sufficient amount of food in the knapsacks. As campaign director, I had research methods at my disposal to determine that, in fact, there was $53 million in the knapsacks of the Trinity congregation. But I don't mean there was $53 million in the discretionary philanthropic budgets of the Trinity congregation. Far from it. It would take a reordering of priorities, a shift in the way each of us thought about our money, about self and other, today versus tomorrow, for that $53 million to be offered up. But it was there. So I knew the campaign goal was too high, and I knew at the same time that it was possible. I was well-versed in the classic tools of fundraising, relationship building, asking, recognizing gifts. In terms of recognizing gifts, I was pretty sure that we were going to have to name every hallway, window, and room in Trinity's church and parish house to inspire the kind of giving we needed. Trinity was blessed with a great teacher in its rector, Sam Lloyd, who's now the dean of Washington National Cathedral. His core message was about stewardship, recognizing the abundance of our lives, feeling grateful, and giving back in gratitude, saying yes to the divine love at the center of the universe. But preaching just gets the words in the air. It is in the development of community that the words are put into practice. And that was what the Capitol campaign was all about. It wasn't ultimately about our National Historic Landmark building or even about our need for gathering space. It was about the process of building a community and putting our faith into practice. We read scripture, we talked about generosity, and we worked toward tithing. I had a sudden realization a year into the job that this was not just about other people's money, but it was about my money too. What could I give? Could I tithe? As we made our gifts, we modeled generosity for each other and inspired ourselves to dare to give more. In December 2004, the Trinity congregation achieved that $53 million goal. I believe at that point it was the second largest congregation-based campaign in the country, with the two others in the top three being evangelical megachurches, Willow Creek in Illinois at $84 million and Rick Warren's Saddleback in Southern California at $50 million. And, of course, although those churches had thousands more members, their key advantage was none of their members lived in Yankee frugal Boston. It still seems like a miracle. We had a challenge grant at the end, and I remember sending an email out saying that we had 10 days and $4.5 million to go. And somehow that $4.5 million appeared. I do not know how many people gave the largest gift of their lives during this capital campaign. I did. My guess is that well over 100 others did too. But to me, the most extraordinary thing about achieving that goal was that we did it without any naming opportunities. At Trinity today, there is one plaque on the wall that lists all the names of the donors in alphabetical order. $1 million donor next to a $50 donor. Back to my point about spiritual hunger. We have a deep desire to be part of something larger than ourselves, something that offers an abundance of meaning and purpose. To accomplish the extraordinary in the context of deep relationships and authentic community, your name on the door of a room just doesn't hold a candle to that. There's a coda to the Capitol campaign story. Well, it seemed like a coda at the time, but actually it turned out to be the beginning of the next chapter. In November 2004, right at the end of Trinity's campaign, I met the Reverend Herman Hamilton. His African-American congregation in Roxbury was in the midst of its own building renovation. And although they had met their initial fundraising goal in the demolition phase of the construction project, they found some very expensive surprises. Now, it was not in Trinity Church's strategic plan to raise money for another church. But the project tugged on me for a couple of months, and eventually I dove in. We hosted a breakfast meeting at Trinity. We invited members of Trinity's congregation and philanthropic partners. Reverend Hamilton invited pastors from the Black Ministerial Alliance and friends from suburban congregations. We had liberal progressive Christians and conservative evangelical Christians and the head of the Jewish Community Relations Council. At the breakfast, Reverend Hamilton told the story of the campaign, including the fact that he and his wife had given the down payment they had saved to buy a house to renovate the church instead. A column in the Boston Globe told the story of the breakfast and the pastor's gift, and within a month we had raised nearly $1 million. In the years since, it has become clear to me and to Reverend Hamilton that the most important outcome of the breakfast and the Roxbury Presbyterian campaign was the set of relationships we formed. Reverend Hamilton leveraged those relationships with extraordinary impact when he later became a driving force in the successful passage of healthcare reform in Massachusetts. The relationships I formed, particularly the working partnership with Reverend Hamilton, set the stage for the creation of the Trinity Boston Foundation. So in 2006, Trinity's assets included an historic building in the heart of the Back Bay with beautiful new program space. We had a large regional congregation with significant financial and social capital. We were a Boston brand that had been around for more than 270 years. The exterior of our building is often the backdrop on the nightly news. We had robust administrative infrastructure, including a very capable finance office. We also had two strong outreach programs with annual operating budgets of about $250,000 each. And, as evidenced by the Roxbury Presbyterian Breakfast, we had convening power. That's a lot of assets in one knapsack. I found myself saying two things. One, there are enough resources in Boston to solve Boston's problems. And two, if we all got to know each other, this would be a different city. So we started thinking about how we could, one, open up Trinity's knapsack and leverage our assets on behalf of the city, and two, find a way to model a generous and collaborative approach to addressing Boston's social issues that would inspire others to join in. In January 2007, the Trinity Boston Foundation took its current form. Trinity's rector, Ann Bonneman, graciously blessed our launch, even though she had only arrived in Boston 2 months before and was still trying to get to know the parish. We worked out a governance structure that assured the Trinity's vestry a measure of control. The church committed a startup grant of $150,000 a year for 2 years. We assumed the management and the expense of the two outreach programs and set a budget that first year of about $900,000. Where would the revenue come from? Remember that part about big ideas and no visible resources? It was a leap of faith. Thankfully, the resources continue to appear, and we've seen 4 years of steady growth. Our programs form a root system for the foundation that keep us intimately connected to peoples and communities across Boston. We could not be effective advocates for social change without the daily effort to engage and empower individual youth, adults, and families in Boston's inner-city neighborhoods. Our largest program, TEEP, the Trinity Education for Excellence program, but we just call it TEEP, empowers students in the Boston Public Schools to achieve excellence. This is a year-round program that engages students from seventh grade all the way through high school and beyond. We excel at taking students who are in the bottom half of their sixth grade class and ensuring that they get to and through college. 100% of the students who complete the six-year program go to college and graduate on time. 70% of them are the first in their families to do this. The program produces leaders, and many of our college graduates are choosing careers working for social change, including one, David Lozano, who just joined our staff as the assistant director of TEEP. Last fall, Root Cause recognized TEEP as one of the top 7 college access programs in Massachusetts. Our other youth-focused program, Street Potential, serves young men caught in the juvenile justice system. Street Potential is part of our counseling center, which targets the epidemic of untreated trauma in distressed neighborhoods, both through individual counseling and work with partner organizations. Like TEEP, Street Potential and the counseling center build our knowledge of social issues and our network of relationships in the city. That knowledge and those relationships inspire us to work for systemic change. Here's one example drawn from Street Potential, where participants in the program are re-entering the community after being locked up for an extended period of time, maybe 6 to 18 months. In Metro Boston, there were 5 community re-entry centers to which these youth had to report after school. This was very convenient for the case managers, having the kids come to them. But it wasn't so great for the youth, because instead of being engaged in positive activities in the community, they came back together again every day after school to be with the people with whom they've been locked up. So we convened a series of meetings with faith partners, nonprofits, and the staff of the relevant government agency, and it turned out that everyone thought it was a bad idea. It had just been the way they'd done it. And so a year later, the system changed. That's our model. Deliver programs, build relationships and partnerships, and work together for change. Critical to the success of this model is a consistent effort to be generous and willing to share and to cast a vision that responds to the hunger for meaning and purpose we see all around us. Here's one way we do that. The foundation holds an annual dinner called Bostonians for Youth. In part, it is a fundraising and marketing effort to build sustained support of our programs, but it aims to be much more. Bostonians for Youth conveys two key messages. The first is that violence, the number two cause of death for youth nationally, and a seemingly intractable product of educational failure, untreated trauma, and a lack of economic opportunity, is not a neighborhood issue, but a Boston issue. The youth on both ends of the guns belong to all of us. The second message is that we can't end violence without deep coordination and collaboration within the social sector. It's not your typical gala. We try hard, as our youth would say, to keep it real. Noted filmmaker Topper Carew produces an original film for the events. You can watch his past films at bostoniansforyouth.org. They're edgy, provocative, not easy to stomach. So you can imagine, you all get dressed up and you go watch edgy films. In the 2009 film, we meet the Odom family and learn that Stephen Odom was murdered at age 13 as he walked home from school. We also meet Rayshond, a street potential participant. And 4 months after that film premiered at our dinner, I went to Rayshond's funeral. We work hard to use the event to raise money, but even more important than that is our effort to develop public will to address the issue. We want to affect people on a deep level so that something will shift inside. A connection will form, an awareness perhaps of the full humanity of the young people caught up in violence, the victims and the survivors. And then we want to empower our guests to get involved. We also model collaboration and generosity by inviting two other organizations to join us for Bostonians for Youth. We organize the event, take a modest management fee, and then split the net proceeds. Our approach inspires individuals to give, and it builds relationships with the other organizations that lead to programmatic partnerships. Those partnerships, in turn, help us leverage each other's assets for greater impact. So what's next? In neighborhoods that are fragmented and suffer from high rates of poverty, violence, and despair, the two institutions most able to generate community are congregations and schools. So if our theory of change involves leveraging existing assets to strengthen communities, it would make sense to focus our investment there. We continue to have a close working partnership with Roxbury Presbyterian Church. I sit on the board of the church, their 501c3 mission arm, the Social Impact Center, and Reverend Hamilton sits on the Trinity Boston Foundation board. Our newest collaboration is around Roxbury Presbyterian's Dream Again campaign. The big idea that the Roxbury community has lost its capacity to dream, and that it's time to help the community dream again. After extensive interviews going door to door in the neighborhood, Reverend Hamilton's congregation decided that the best way to reach a large number of neighbors would be to adopt a nearby public school in danger of being shut down. One reason that inner city schools may not generate community is that the parents and guardians are focused on daily survival needs and lack discretionary time, or English language fluency, and or the comfort and soft skills needed to get involved. So if the families can't create community at the schools, can a faith community adopt a school, wrap it in love, and inspire and empower parents, students, and teachers to find new hope? Roxbury Presbyterian is developing the model, and Trinity has become a secondary partner at the Dearborn Middle School, which is now dreaming of becoming a 6 through 12 early college science, technology, engineering, and math school. So you have a failing school, and we want to make of it a model for the whole state. We don't have one of these in Massachusetts. And with the help of Roxbury Presbyterian, the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, and Trinity, that dream has already garnered a $40 million commitment from the state to renovate the building. And having learned the partnership model from Roxbury Presbyterian, Trinity plans to adopt our own public school and hopes to inspire other communities to do the same. I hope I'm not making this sound too easy. It is really hard work, and the tension between faith calling and best business practice runs high. Serving on the board of the Social Impact Center requires either a lot of faith or a huge appetite for risk. Their expense budget is less than $150,000 a year, but they have no operating reserves, and the balance in their checking account is rarely above $10,000. And yet, as Reverend Hamilton says, if we based our actions on our checking account, the Dearborn would not have a $40 million commitment from the state. Faith prompts action. And a lack of cash can necessitate partnerships and leveraging existing assets. It's hard, but it can work. Over at Trinity, the numbers are not quite that daunting. But nevertheless, the tension persists. In January, the foundation board looked hard at two numbers. The first was our $20,000 operating deficit for 2010, which we needed to cover from our meager operating reserves. And the second was the fact that we had given $135,000 to other organizations, $55,000 each to our two Bostonians for Youth Partners, and $25,000 we had raised in response to the earthquake in Haiti and used to inspire a much larger citywide faith offering. So on a $1.3 million expense budget, we had both run a deficit and tithed. Best business practice? Not sure. Faith calling? I hope so. 4+ years into the experiment of the Trinity Boston Foundation, we have created something that I hope will be as enduring as our 278-year-old parish. We've raised over $5 million, delivered successful programs, developed ways to increase collaboration and coordination within our sector, and built significant citywide partnerships and coalitions to create systemic change. Nevertheless, the dropout rate in Boston schools is still too high and the graduation rate too low. College entrance and completion statistics describe a generation of young men and women with very little chance of social mobility. An African-American boy in the ninth grade in the Boston Public Schools has a 7% chance of graduating from college. There were 70 murders in Boston last year and many more non-fatal shootings. It is tempting to think that the problems are too great and too difficult, to think as the disciples did that we need to send the crowd away so that it can fend for itself. But I hear what Jesus said when the task seemed impossible and there were no visible resources in sight. You give them something to eat. And so we press on, forming relationships and community, modeling generosity, and giving what we have so that all will be fed. Our tagline at the Trinity Boston Foundation is "Together, let's change the odds." But unless we get the together right, there's no way we will succeed. Thank you.
Our thanks to Louise Burnham Packard for such an inspirational talk, for mentioning Jesus more than any of our other speakers combined.
That was my job, wasn't it?
That was your job. And for bringing tears to the eyes of this New York Jew. It's a very inspirational talk.
Thank
you very much. I want to encourage people to write questions as we go through the Q&A, but we have three kind of groups of questions. One is about the Trinity Boston Foundation itself. One is about faith-based organizations. Mm-hmm. And the other, well, actually four. One is about Boston and its atypical nature versus how generalizable it may be. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, because you are part of the series on social entrepreneurship, I want to talk about social entrepreneurship and social innovation within faith-based organizations and how they complement and work with the larger discourse that's mm-hmm. going on. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with the Trinity Boston Foundation, the easy one first.
Okay.
Whose idea was it to turn the Dearborn School into a science school? Tell us about how that evolved, and what kinds of conversations did you have in Boston to make you think that you could do that?
The idea for the Dearborn School came in part from a whole lot of conversations that Roxbury Presbyterian and the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization had with parents and teachers and community members. The Dearborn is right in the Dudley Square neighborhood in Roxbury, and the thought was that it shouldn't just be a good school. It's a failing school. It had a one-year leash to be turned around, but in fact, it needed to become a model that would draw people from other neighborhoods to want to come to school in Roxbury. So I think there were conversations within the school community and then also with the Boston Public School superintendent, where it got floated as one of several ideas, and I went to a organizing meeting that probably had 300 or 400 people at it, and we all got into small groups and we voted on several potential models, and that was the one that everybody liked the best. I think because the notion is that that's where the jobs are going to be. And then in following up on that, we got the idea of early college. If they could graduate already with some college credits, that would help toward the college completion rate, which is so dismal.
Now, if any of you have not seen a picture of Trinity Church in Boston, it is a fabulous building, and it's in a very kind of she-she part of the city at the end of Newbury Street. And it's I want to talk a little bit about race and Trinity Church. I assume, and I may be wrong, that a fair number of the congregants of the church are white. Mm-hmm. How does race play a role in your outreach to neighborhoods mm-hmm. at risk, mm-hmm. which may or may not be white?
Mm-hmm. So it is true that if you look around the church on a given Sunday, you're going to see more white faces than not. With the exception of our Nigerian congregation and particularly the congregation from, there's a contingent of people from Barbados where the Episcopal Church is strong. But I think that it is exactly our location and our congregation that made us really want to develop this relationship with Roxbury Presbyterian Church, because if you think about where the assets are, what Reverend Hamilton's congregation has is deep connections to the African-American community in Roxbury and the street credibility, so that working together we can get a lot done and we bring Trinity's assets to it. I hope that that in the process, also the volunteer pool the Ready Volunteer pool we have access to at Trinity, getting engaged, working alongside with the congregation at Roxbury Presbyterian, again, creates this stronger social fabric in the city. So we have two volunteers who go volunteer in the library at the Dearborn School every Friday, along with some volunteers from Roxbury Presbyterian, and they've become fast friends, which means that now when the deacons are having a tag sale at Roxbury Presbyterian, Trinity can get connected. So do you want more than that?
Well, I just wonder in terms of challenges, if it's just a matter of personal connections, or did you have to develop your own credibility to reach out into Roxbury and other neighborhoods?
Yes, and I think that that the Roxbury Presbyterian, the campaign breakfast, where we were willing to put our sort of, we were willing to say this is really important for the city that this church is able to complete its capital campaign. That did a lot for our credibility and also, frankly, for the relationships. I had to work through that process because I think that I made a lot of friends out in the city, because I think they were hoping that I could just do that every month or so and raise the next million for their church or their project, and it didn't quite work like that. But yes, absolutely, and it is hard because Roxbury Presbyterian is a small church and Trinity is not, and Trinity parishioners tend to think that if they come into a situation they have the answer and can make stuff happen, and that's not how you do partnership. So there's been a lot of learning to how not to be the 800-pound gorilla coming in and saying, okay, we're going to fix this. It's been quite a journey.
There's some specific questions about TEEP itself. Is it fully funded by Trinity Boston Foundation, or does it get other funding?
Well, remember the part in the beginning, we actually don't have any money at Trinity Boston Foundation. So it is fully funded by our donors, both by foundation. We get foundation grants for it. We get individual gifts for it. We raise money through Bostonians for Youth and the Rodman Ride for Kids bike ride, and we scramble for money all year round.
Can you talk about the foundation's participation in gun eradication efforts and how that's worked?
We have not been part of a gun campaign at this point.
Are there gun campaigns?
There is not a big one emerging in the city at this point. Uh-huh. If there were, I think we would be getting on board.
What do you think is the most innovative aspects of the Trinity Boston Foundation?
I think it is the modeling generosity piece. And it is the part that writing those checks to the partner organizations and deciding that we should not only give money to Haiti, but, we should give a lot of money to Haiti, and we should challenge all the other congregations to give money, too. When you think about sort of year-end crisis or year-end fundraising and the pressure of that, it's hard to be generous year-round. It's also hard to be generous with my time and my staff's time because people... it's not only just about money, it's about giving advice and helping other people launch ventures and collaborate. And there's only so much time, so that becomes a
But Louise, if we think about any church in any community, they're going to have, some kind of charitable outreach. They provide meals, they provide this. What is it that really sets the Trinity Boston Foundation apart from those other types of generous activities?
Well, I think in part it is our the ambition to scale that we have in the location that we are in. Mm-hmm. I think there are, there are African-American churches in, there's one in Brooklyn that has huge social service programs, millions and millions of dollars. And but we don't have to in Back Bay. And so I think one of the innovative things is that we've decided to do it and to do it in the way that we're doing it.
Okay. Faith-based organizations, when I use that term, especially here we are in the San Francisco Bay Area, people say, what? Faith-based? It certainly has received some stigma, I suppose, during the Bush administration, really. What do you think that stigma still exists, and or do you experience that, or is that a kind of a Bay Area phenomenon, and maybe I just haven't seen beyond the bridges, or how does that impact you?
So the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives that President Bush put together, I think, was primarily an effort to blur the line between faith-based organizations and community organizations and make faith-based organizations eligible for federal funding. The trick is that to get federal funding, you have to serve anyone, not just people of a particular faith, and you have to be willing to hire anyone and not just people of a particular faith. So what faith-based looks like in that situation can take a awfully big range of forms. In the current administration is the notion of what is the faith-based administration sort of broadening from a more conservative focus to the, getting the progressives on board as well? Yes, I think so. And I hope that will continue over time.
There's a member of our audience who says that when she, or it might be a he, but I'll assume it's a she, because it's a very good question. no, it's not that easy. That when she goes to her congregation and says, let's do more in the community, she's told that the church is there to serve God and not the community. Did you experience that? And if so, what did you do to win over that kind of thinking?
Yes. And one of the arguments that I hear is we are not a social service agency. There are social service agencies, and they're supposed to do that, and we're supposed to be about worship and praise. And I think that there are two pieces of this. So one is a theological piece about really what was in our faith tradition, what really was Jesus saying about when he said, you know, to feed the hungry and clothe the naked, and I think that what happens in congregations is that part gets pushed aside because that's the hard part, and so we focus on the stuff that we do in church on Sunday because that's the easy part. So that's one piece. The other is, and this gets back to what I think is at the core of a faith-based organization, is am I trying to do this in partnership with that divine love I was talking about? And, you know, that gets us out on a limb in the Commonwealth Club, I'm sure. But the thought is, am I trying to see what is happening around me and respond to it? Or is this all just about analysis of a need and how do I line up the resources and make it happen? That's not what it is for me. Mm-hmm. And when I say, you know, the Roxbury Presbyterian Project just kept tugging at me, it wasn't in our plan, but I just finally knew I had to do it. Well, that's a faith-based piece, not some analytical piece. And so I always welcome those conversations because it gives me a chance to talk about it, but yes, I hear that a lot.
Well, it's a segue into the other set of questions, and I'll actually swing back to the foundation. But in this discourse about social entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurship, the business model, is an important kind of theme throughout our whole mm-hmm. series. And many would argue that social entrepreneurship is applying business rigor to a social issue. Mm-hmm. What's your answer to that? Are you a social entrepreneur?
I apply as much business rigor as I can at any time to what we're doing. I think to the extent that we're innovative and we are pushing the envelope, I feel like we fall in that social enterprise category. We're still in startup mode, so it's been 4 years. I think what happens is you kind of go out and do, and then when you get a little bit bigger, you can stop and invest more in your sort of business infrastructure. And then you get a little bigger, and then you got to stop and invest more. We're in one of those second round stages right now where we're sort of going back and trying to put in the whole next level of management infrastructure. My first hire was an MBA because I knew I needed that that discipline and that practice. But, you know, along with that, there are all the questions about metrics. Can I go there?
Yeah.
That I think it's something that you hear a lot about in the social enterprise conversation, and that has fed into the foundations, and now we're all metrics, metrics, metrics. And it's really important, but there are some things that those metrics, it's very hard. We haven't figured out how to capture them yet. So why exactly do all of our TEEP students go to college? How empowered is someone? How much hope do they have? You know, even my whole point about community connection and cohesion, if someone would come up with a good metric, how do you know you've built the social fabric of the city? I'd love to figure that out. So I think some of the stuff we're focused on, it's hard to get into that metrics conversation, but maybe we'll figure that out.
But you are asked by foundations to provide measurement and proof of efficacy all the time.
All the time, which is why we were so thrilled about the root cause study that made us one of the top college access programs, they had a 43-page questionnaire. We were calling it Root Canal, but we slogged our way through it. And so, you know, we have the metrics. The most tangible metrics. I mean, the hardest one is our Street Potential program, where you're working with court-involved youth, and, you know, you're not getting them to college necessarily, and so you think, well, if they get arrested less often, is that a good metric? You know, we don't know how to do that yet.
What is the breakdown of the funding that goes through the Boston, that goes through the Trinity Boston Foundation?
Where does it come from?
Yeah.
So it's about a quarter from foundations, a quarter from individual gifts, a quarter from events, and a quarter that is Trinity Church, which still gives us a small grant. And we have contracts with nonprofit partners, and we have some government contracts as well. So it's pretty well diversified.
And is that diversification the key to sustainability? A lot of discussion is about sustainable income streams and creating
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, we've worked really hard at that diversity because you figure that, you know, the government funding may shrink, but you've got a lot of other sources in play. So that's been important.
So, Louise, I recently heard a story about a very large church who agreed to put a Subway sandwich franchise in their church in order to create jobs for their out-of-work youth and split the revenue with Subway. Is that going too far, or is that innovative, or what? I mean, are churches kind of are some churches at the cutting edge of what's possible?
We've talked about a Starbucks franchise. That's what we'd all like
well,
to have.
Well, you are in Back Bay after all.
And there are only three within a block, but we think one more would help. We have, in the capital campaign, the building renovation, we put in a restaurant kitchen. And talk about assets that I have my eye on. I'm really interested in that restaurant kitchen. If you think about, you know, we have the John Hancock Tower right next door and all that summer lunching that happens on Copley Square. We have thought a lot about getting some of our youth involved in that. The issue is that the more you put into place like that, the less flexibility the church has about its facilities. So our TEEP program takes over all the program space for the church in the summer, and that works out okay because the programming really drops off for the parish in the summer. But if we were going to give Subway the kitchen, mm-hmm. that would cut into what the parishioners are able to do. But I'm all for that kind of effort.
Louise, there's a lot of programs and conferences and gatherings within the social entrepreneurship and social innovation space. But as we've discussed, to my knowledge and to your knowledge, the faith-based social entrepreneurs are not as much a part as perhaps they may be further downstream. Are there gatherings within the faith-based community for social innovation or social entrepreneurship? Where is the partnership within this kind of concept area?
Mm-hmm. I don't know of them. I know within the Episcopal Church there are gatherings where this might be a conversation, and maybe that's true in other denominations. But I don't think there is one sort of. Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe I just haven't been invited.
But I don't think there's a big interfaith conference. We don't. You have to do a little translation between the social enterprise conversation and the faith-based conversation. And I don't think that. I think faith-based institutions who are doing social service programs like ours are more inclined to be talking to the nonprofit partners, the neighbors in their city because they're trying to get something done than think about what the national conversation is. Again, I may be wrong on that.
Okay. Do you believe that faith-based institutions should be politically active?
I think it's pretty hard not to be, because again, when you're working on the ground and you see the issues, it's pretty hard not to get involved where the big changes can happen at the government level.
So how does that manifest itself in your life?
So it manifests itself in my life because for example, at the Dearborn School, we just had an action getting the city council members who are going to have to vote on the city part of the funding that matches the state funding. We just had a big action to get them to the school and impress upon them how many people care how they vote on this issue. So that's, you know, on the local level, that we do a lot of that kind of community organizing and action. And then on the state level, I certainly always go to the lobby days and the visit my legislators about after-school programming, funding for youth, funding for our Department of Youth Services that funds the court-involved young men and women. So it's a lot about conversation and connection.
Another big thread throughout this series and throughout the discourse on social entrepreneurship is the notion of scale and how to scale up. My question is the relationship between scale and systemic change. But in your view, how do you scale, and what are your ambitions in that regard?
You know, we think about that a lot because one of the models that seem to be out there in the social enterprise conversation, particularly about, say, youth development programs, is that as soon as you get multi-city, then you're a national organization, and then you can attract a whole lot of funding because people like that you're going to scale. And you could have pretty small programs in a number of cities, but that puts you a whole category ahead. And to my way of thinking, that the deeper you get into the community, the more you can change the community. And so if you're focused on replicating in four other cities, how do you go deep in those cities? You end up being very focused on your program model and how do you replicate your program model, but you're not developing the kind of ties that do all the things I talked about. Mm-hmm. So we've thought about it. We've thought about TEEPS. Should we try to start having TEEPS in other cities? And actually, it started in New Orleans, so it already is multi-city.
It's national.
It's national. That's right. It's in two cities, so it's national. But I think the where to go with TEEPS actually is to figure out how to build leadership academies within public schools in Boston, so you're actually serving a whole lot more people. But that doesn't get you the same attention that if we went to multiple cities. So we'll see.
Now, Louise, you've lived in multiple cities.
I have.
What are the characteristics that are generalizable about Boston to other cities that you've used as part of the resources in your knapsack, and also are there idiosyncratic aspects that are different? Is your model replicable in other cities, and if so, what would be the characteristics you draw upon?
I would absolutely think it's replicable in other cities, not by me, but by other institutions. And by the way, I actually think you could, if you took our lens of saying what are our assets, you could do that. In fact, I've mentioned this to the now dean of Harvard Business School, that I think there should just be a little group inside of Harvard Business School trying to figure out how to leverage the assets of the business school on behalf of Cambridge and Boston. But, you know, what are characteristics of Boston? It's a small city. It is not impossible for us to all get to know each other. And we've had a bad history of segregation. We have a big wound in our collective psyche about busing, and there is a lot that divides us. But I've really seen a movement toward building more connection and trying to come together. I think there even may start being public conversations about the busing crisis, and that just shows you that people are collectively are trying to heal the city. And that would be pretty exciting. I think it's replicable because it's just a matter of looking up from your business plan, your business model, and trying to figure out what's going on around you and how you can connect.
Okay. So one of the key differences, I think, between what you're talking about and some of the other speakers in our series is that there's sometimes this lone ranger metaphor of the social entrepreneur out there, you know, with his or her idea, you know, making it happen. Mm-hmm. And how does that play out for you, that metaphor?
I don't like the lone ranger part because I think, you know, for any enterprise to get off the ground, there has to be a team. But I do understand why we think about it that way, because somebody has to sort of embody the vision and be the driving force. And I know that I've had a big team at Trinity, but you know, it's certainly the entrepreneurial pain of the first few years has been, you know, heavily mine to sort of carry and bear. I think we have to resist the star system of lone entrepreneurs taking on the world because, A, I don't think it's healthy, and B, it makes it so much harder to collaborate when someone has staked their whole identity on this organization. So why would you partner? I'm going to prove my model and, you know, attract my funding. You know, it doesn't work to then say, well, actually, there's 16 organizations in the city that all have to do this right to really make the change. You have to be saying, my organization is going to make the change.
Right.
And that's worth resisting.
So, Louise, we have time for one last question. And this actually is a question. What is your life legacy? Which is a pretty good question. What are you going to be proudest of in developing this?
Well, you know, at the end of the Trinity campaign, I thought it was going to be the Trinity campaign. I had a board member who said, this will go on your life resume, Louise, that that you directed this campaign. And then, as I think I said in my speech, I realized that it was just the prelude for the next piece. I hope that I will have inspired generosity. I hope that some people will think about their lives differently and think about their money differently and think about their opportunity to contribute differently. And I hope that the Trinity Boston Foundation will not just be a four-year startup, but will be around for many, many years to come.
Our thanks to Louise Burnham Packard. We also want to thank you, our audience, and the audience on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been the 10th in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.